You are listening to the War on the Rocks podcast on strategy, defense, and foreign affairs. My name's Ryan Evans. I'm the editor-in-chief of War on the Rocks. In this episode, there are two guests. First, I called up John Bew to talk about where the special relationship between the U.S. and the U.K. is heading. John is professor of history and foreign policy at the War Studies Department at King's College London. He's the author of Realpolitik, A History, and is leading a project on Britain's place in the world for the think tank Policy Exchange. His most recent book, Clement Attlee, The Man Who Made Modern Britain, is coming out in the U.S. this month. This is the American edition. In the U.K., it has already won numerous awards, including Best Book in the Parliamentary Book Awards. But there's also a dash of Asia right in the middle of this episode. I spoke for that with Van Jackson. Van is an associate professor at the Asia-Pacific Center for Security Studies in Honolulu. He's also an adjunct senior fellow at the Center for New American Security in Washington, as well as, most importantly, of course, a senior editor for War on the Rocks. Van is the author of Rival Reputations, Coercion and Credibility in U.S.-North Korea Relations, which just came out last year. And for our purposes, I should also note that Van is the host of the excellent podcast that he produces with War on the Rocks called Pacific Pundit. John is an old friend of mine, and I always turn to him to help read the tea leaves of British politics. I consider Britain to be our most important strategic ally, but given their impending exit from the European Union, Donald Trump's open skepticism about NATO, and stagnant Western European defense budgets, there are reasons to be concerned over U.S. defense ties to Europe and the future of our special relationship with Britain specifically. Prime Minister Theresa May recently visited the United States, becoming the first head of government to meet with President Trump. This visit was important for May, who is eager for a free trade deal, and ostensibly successful. But it wasn't long until the U.K. Parliament made it clear that Trump was not welcome to deliver a speech in Parliament during his upcoming trip to the U.K. This is a reaction to both Trump the man and his recent executive order banning immigrants and refugees from 7 Muslim-majority countries. I asked John what I should make of all this.
Yeah, so after the visit to the White House, Theresa May flew directly to Ankara to meet the Turkish president and talk through a trade deal there. And in that press conference, she expected to get a rough time about the Turkish human rights record, the sort of creep of autocracy in Turkey. And actually what happened was that she was had a few skittles thrown at her about Trump's the travel ban, that kind of followed her over the Atlantic. And that's become a kind of a live issue that won't go away. So the Prime Minister is pretty unrepentant that her visit to the U.S. was a success. And I think you've got to see it through the prism not only of the White House visit, but also the speech in Philadelphia to senior Republicans as well. I think it was a two-pronged strategy. What she said there, and what's the British obsessed about the special relationship, so we really it was front page story here, but actually we realized that it wasn't covered that much in the States. And when I referred to, in conversations with American friends, to Theresa's speech, they didn't know what I was talking about. So what she said there was quite striking. Really, what she did in the first instance, so it's a two-pronged visit. She went to the White House at the weekend, but on the Thursday, the day she arrived, she addressed the Republican establishment, essentially, in Philadelphia. And what she did was pitch for a deeper, more serious alliance. Now, in that broader Republican establishment, pre-Trump and pre his election, there was a growing receptiveness to the idea of a US-UK trade deal. So she wanted to focus fastened on that. But she made a sort of broader case for Britain as a burden sharer and being serious about a return to some sort of Western leadership and a series of problems. She denounced and distanced herself from previous British interventionism or liberal interventionism under David Cameron and Tony Blair, but not in a way that was supposed to be a prelude to sort of isolationism or a narrow focus simply on the national interest. So she presented Britain as a more likely ally on Iran. That is a change in British foreign policy. She was much more open and friendly about British foreign policy, has been inclined to be in the last few years. So it was a pitch for a relationship, or a renewed relationship, that might go beyond the White House as well. That was the first stage in it. Obviously, the second staging post was going to the White House and having these direct contacts with Trump. What's really striking about that is that congratulatory phone calls that went to Trump after his election, the British press made much about the fact that Theresa was the 11th to get on the phone. But for whatever reason, in the White House or elsewhere, the Anglo-American relationship is one of the good news stories, one of the less controversial stories. So out of nowhere, what's happened is that this relationship's assumed this elevated importance again, and it couldn't be not be more timely for Britain. And no matter what happens in British Parliament, no matter how much resistance or criticism she gets, May regards her visit to DC and Philadelphia as a serious success. Above all, getting Trump and putting the words in his mouth of 100% commitment to NATO.
I then brought up Brexit specifically. I want to know how this relates to Britain's developing relationships with both Europe and the United States.
Yes, so there was a court ruling that said there had to be a parliamentary vote. That parliamentary vote has passed. What really matters in the Brexit discussion is what type of Brexit the British Prime Minister is going to push for, and whether it would be a soft Brexit, which was essentially try and maintain a lot of the old system and keep Britain in certain rules and regulations. Actually, Theresa May, for political reasons, but also with enough strategic rationale to make it a kind of an educated guess, because no one knows what happens next, has opted for a pretty hard Brexit, which involves taking Britain out of the customs union, a pretty serious divorce from the European Union. So that's the kind of current sort of status quo on that. Now, for that, there has been a bit of ganging up in various European capitals, and I say that's not completely shared across the board. I suspect Angela Merkel and the German government still want a pretty effective, close relationship with Britain and still want and don't want to jeopardize that. However, there's a certain portion of the European bureaucratic classes who have been wanting to gang up on Britain. So the reason why the special relationship assumes this renewed importance, because imagine the other scenario. Imagine if Hillary Clinton had won. Senior Democrats made no secret of the fact that they thought Brexit was a bad idea. President Obama has said himself, partly at the request of David Cameron, it has to be said, and he's got a lot of unfair flack about this, but said that Britain would find itself at the back of the queue on a trade deal. That changed overnight under Trump. So while if you did a straw poll of British parliamentarians and MPs, including on the Conservative side, I bet you would count on a handful those who had prepared to celebrate or praise Donald Trump. And right back, by the way, to the Obama-McCain race 8 years ago or 9 years ago, that was a similar theme as well. Actually, even though John McCain was widely respected, a significant portion of conservative MPs were very pro-Obama. There's no love lost for Trump, but actually the door has opened as one has been shut. And, Theresa May's got very little option but to run through that door and do what Britain can do in that situation.
I brought it back to the UK parliamentary decision to deny Trump the opportunity to make a speech in Parliament.
Yeah, I mean, so Donald Trump's been granted a state visit, okay, which is a higher form of visit, and the British love their ceremonies, okay, so as opposed to just an official visit. A state visit means you get to meet the Queen, essentially. Okay, now within that, the choreography is very flexible because we have no constitution, we make it up as we go along, and we are all about sort of custom and tradition. And one of the things that normally happens with a state visit is that the person being invited will have the opportunity to address both Houses of Parliament. But in certain cases, that doesn't happen. The Speaker of the House of Commons, who is supposed to be impartial on matters of procedure, has said, no, we won't allow Parliament to deliver a speech to both Houses of Parliament. I wonder, actually, in an odd type of way, that's a bit of a gift to the government, because you're able to stage manage the affair much more easily. You're less worried about the boo hissing or the complaining from British MPs, and it might actually be a sort of secret gift to the government. It wasn't intended as such, but I think that'll all blow over relatively soon. Now, there will be protests on the street. A million and a half Britons signed a petition calling for Trump to be banned from the UK, but actually something has to be said about the petition. Of that million and a half, nearly all of them are in London, which is highly politicized, of a certain sort of political stripe. Most of the rest of the country kind of, in that phlegmatic British way, raise their eyebrows.
We're going to take a short break from John and shift our gaze to North Korea. When I need to understand what's going on with North Korea, I call up my friend and senior War on the Rocks editor, Van Jackson. Van is the host of a new podcast called Pacific Pundit. Its focus is on all things Asia security affairs, and if you haven't subscribed to the Pacific Pundit feed, you should do so right now. We spoke about the grand presidential tradition of ignoring North Korea, which seems set to continue in the Trump administration.
So why do American presidents not pay enough attention to North Korea?
Well, so the reality is that every American president since LBJ has not given a shit about North Korea until it's too late, until North Korea forces you to care. And even then, it's only temporary. The reason is that North Korea is not a unidimensional problem, right? There's a threat of war that's very real, but there's also a very real proliferation threat. And North Korea and how we deal with it is like a leading indicator of America's ability to preserve its alliances and like claim that there's any semblance of order or stability in Asia. So that's not even like a dilemma, that's a trilemma, right? And each of those things requires like a different kind of priority set or privileges different tools of policy than the others. Like you can't actually pursue all these things simultaneously. So, right, with strategy 101, if everything is a priority, then nothing is. And so nobody has been willing to make decisions on North Korea. Everybody wants to pass the buck to the next president. And you see that right now with Obama to Trump. And despite Obama's warnings about North Korea being kind of the top priority national security issue, so far we've seen nothing from the Trump administration on North Korea except for a single tweet.
It seems like, I mean, I'm obviously not an Asia area expert, but it seems like U.S. policy in North Korea has been pretty stagnant since the 90s, where there's this process by which the U.S. offers talks and some sort of sanctions relief and food aid in exchange for North Korea trying to get North Korea to stop doing things on the nuclear weapons front. That doesn't work. The North Korean weapons program keeps becoming more of a real thing, keeps becoming bigger. They make advances in missiles. And despite that, the U.S. seems like we're still trapped in that way of thinking that, well, if we just ratchet up sanctions, offer to ratchet them down, engage in talks, maybe something will work one day. Why are we stuck in that cycle? Is that a fair depiction?
Tragically, that's totally fair depiction. We're stuck in that kind of cycle. I hate using the term cycle, but like we're stuck in that pattern because no president wants to set priorities or take risks, right? The Clinton administration had an opportunity to resolve this by taking a kind of political risk or a diplomatic risk, right? They were on the like rapprochement compromise footing, but they wouldn't go all in with it. And their failure to go all in with it meant that we could never actually find out if North Korea would sincerely bite on having a better relationship with us and having better terms and being willing to like actually denuclearize. And then it was sort of the opposite with the Bush administration and the Obama administration. Like no, everybody's trying to be too clever by half. Oh, let's mix carrots and sticks. But like other than Henry Kissinger, like nobody can really do that well. And so we don't take risks, we don't set priorities, and we just try to pass the buck. And so you mess around with things that only matter on the periphery, like sanctions, and then you focus all your policy attention on these little things. We do this with the South China Sea, too, by focusing on like FONOPS. These are things that don't change policy outcomes, but we debate them endlessly as if they're really significant. And it takes your eye off of anything that actually might have been consequential. You know, so we're stuck in this pattern because we don't like to take risks. We don't like to set priorities. And the problem now, this is what Obama tried to warn Trump about, supposedly, is the North Korea problem is becoming too acute. If we keep with this pattern of like indecisiveness and kind of policy paralysis on North Korea, it's going to be checkmate eventually, where North Korea can hit the homeland with nuclear armed ballistic missiles. Some people think it can happen now, but even if they can't, it'll happen soon enough. And which means we either have to pull up stakes, cede Asia to China, and walk away from our alliances, or keep up with the pretensions that these things still exist when people know that they're hollow. That's a problem.
Often when North Korea behaves badly, either by firing a missile over Japan or something else, we say, well, it's really time to deliver the ultimatum to China and make China own this problem or own part of this problem. And you sort of hear a lot of noises about that. Nothing ever happens. Is that even a feasible policy option, you think?
No, China sucks on North Korea. There's a saying that like China and North Korea are as close as lips and teeth. And the saying is very like memorable because it's so vivid, but it's not true. It's not anchored in fact at all. China and North Korea have always had a shitty relationship, and it's no different today. It's arguably worse today than ever. Since when can you positively influence somebody with whom you've got a shitty relationship, right? So the lips and teeth misconception, that myth, makes people think that China has leverage over North Korea. But the only leverage they have undermines China's own interests. So China can't, if you don't have leverage, if the leverage you have is leverage you can't use. And so that's the dilemma. And we use China, presidents use China as a scapegoat, as an excuse to not do anything. We frame it as China's problem.
Of course.
There's no pain point that we have over China that would in turn make China increase or exploit its potential leverage with North Korea. The fundamental problem, everybody talks about like North Korean refugee flows. The fundamental problem is that Beijing does not want a nuclear armed neighbor whose missiles aim at Beijing. China is perfectly happy to have North Korea be an enemy of South Korea or the US, have those missiles aimed south, east, but not at Beijing. So that puts a cap on what China can do. China wants a friend or a, you know, at least an alien on their border, not an enemy.
First, what would be your sort of ideal North Korea policy that you would like to see a U.S. president pursue? Second, would you want Donald Trump to be the one that executes this, given that every issue he seems to be focusing on lately turns to crap?
So the answer to the second part is definitely no. We're entering a world now where people are taking the idea of preventive strikes against North Korea, against North Korean nuclear facilities, like more seriously. And you have serious people talking about that as an option. But the circumstances now are more adverse to us. They're shittier than they've ever been because North Korea's nuclear arsenal is diversifying because it has road mobile missiles, right? Because it's pursuing an SLBM, which you can't just preventively strike. And so the situation now is becoming more difficult to conduct that kind of activity. But in the Clinton administration and in the Bush administration, that kind of thing could have been pulled off more easily with less risk. And so if anybody was going to do this, I'd want the Obama administration to do it. You've got the steady hand on the ship kind of thing. And this is like a high risk gambit. I would not be keen on having the Trump administration do it, especially under these current circumstances. So the ideal policy right now is to like have the preventive strike option in your back pocket, but really focus on trying to use diplomacy, one, to show that we're still relevant in the region, right? We have a convening power, that we're not just sitting idle. So that says something about our relevance to the region. But so even if nothing comes out of diplomacy, the fact that we're able to do it is positive. But also come off of the goal of denuclearization. That fixation has boxed us in for a long time, especially because North Korea doesn't want to denuclearize. There's nothing to talk about. So we have to get into a more modest mindset about what we're trying to achieve, which is more of a freeze, a moratorium, arms control. And the non-proliferation hawks will like go apeshit if that's what you do, but that's where we are. That's the reality of the situation.
So there's so much more to talk about with North Korea. People can hear about it on your podcast that distributed by War on the Rocks, Pacific Pundit.
Yeah.
I think a lot of War on the Rocks listeners have heard about it. More are going to start signing up for it. More have been signing up for it. But why don't you tell us a bit about what you're trying to achieve with Pacific Pundit?
Yeah, so professional incentives and discussions happen in these silos, right? And War on the Rocks tries to break them down. You have the world of theory and academia. So you have political scientists talking to political scientists. You have historians who are focused on the past, not so much focused on the present. Oftentimes, that's changing. And you have policymakers who just care about the so what, right? And all of these things are relevant to the others. I've touched them all in my own background. And so what I try to do with this podcast is bring in theory, history, and questions of policy debates to have a kind of like hybrid discussion where one informs the other. So each episode is thematically driven around a particular question or issue. And we bring in, without prejudice, theory, history, and policy experts to discuss.
Back to John Bew and the special relationship. I asked John about the British defense budget, both in the context of Brexit, which will leave NATO as Britain's most important remaining institutional relationship to Europe, and in the context of Trump, who has repeatedly demanded that Europe shoulder more of the burden for its own defense. Can Britain do better on defense? Will it?
So in 2010, the British defense budget was in a pretty bad state, and the Strategic Defense and Security Review of that year has kind of been roundly criticized, often, perhaps with the benefit of hindsight, but British defenses weren't in a particularly strong way. Since 2010 through 2015, there's a crucial budget by which Britain got itself up seriously to the 2% commitment to GDP. But even then, slightly the numbers have been cooked. I suspect there's a growing recognition. Plenty of the people I talk to have said that, the levels of defense spending are pretty hopeless anyway. If you consider that in 1945, Britain spent 18% of defense spending on GDP, and we are entering into choppy, dangerous, treacherous international waters. Well, so there is an appetite to do more than that.
Sorry to interrupt, but is it fair to compare anything to the last year of World War II?
No, I think I don't want to be hysterical at all. Absolutely. It's very different, right? Last year of World War II, there's no commitment like that. But unquestionably, it's quite a low number. And it's an arbitrary number that was befitted to a previous era. So what's happened is that Britain got itself up to that 2% in a serious way and is encouraging others to do so. And of America's allies, it's not perfect, but it is one of the more effective burden sharers if you think about, the situation in the 21st century and the various wars in which the United States has been engaged. Not a great burden share, a bit of a free rider, to borrow the Obama-ism. However, having got itself up to 2%, I think what's dawning on a lot of strategic planners and those in and around the pretty robust, if not hawkish, Defense Secretary Michael Fallon, is it really that 2% itself might not be enough? So I wouldn't bet my house on it, but I would suspect there's more and more pressure to do more on defense, and that will be a big British theme going forward in the Anglo-American relationship. Rather than simply, resorting to these sort of hackneyed cliches about the Churchill bust in the White House, etc., Britain has to get more serious about defense. It's putting more of its eggs in this basket by necessity, partly by luck, and partly by choice. So it's going to have to be more serious about it, absolutely. And that does potentially give it a little bit of leverage in broader European negotiations, because it is the most serious European army when it comes to defense. Has also built a pretty good Anglo-French cooperation in the last few years as well. It'll be interesting to see how that plays over the next 5-10 years.
John then gave me his long-term view of the real problems with the special relationship, from his own point of view and his read on American perspectives.
The politics of it, what I'd say about it is that as a supporter and a believer in a close Anglo-American connection, and I say that as a Brit whose own country's national interest is the most important in the first instance, and also as a historian who's written about just how highly contingent that we all talk about this world order under threat, but the order from established Bretton Woods through NATO and the United Nations, just how sort of accidental contingent it was, and we can't sort of take those things for granted. But I'm a believer in those things. My concern in the last few years has been the Brits, in particular, have got A, complacent about defense, and B, resort to these kind of cliches or stories or about the Churchill bust or the photo calls at Camp David, and actually the substance of the relationship hadn't really been seriously thought through. And I also sense a kind of growing sense of exasperation across the political spectrum in D.C. from the Democrat side. It was Obama who adverted to the his anti-free rider campaign, but people took Trump's complaints about a lack of burden sharing in NATO seriously in the UK and knew they were partially directed at us too. So there's a new seriousness about that and a new concern about that, as much as anything in politics, often too late. But that's certainly a kind of a big theme. But strangely and out of nowhere, as I say, Anglo-American relations have assumed this sort of odd importance again, for whatever reason, and partly through great historical accident and no one saw the Trump presidency coming here. I really can tell you that no one saw it coming here. There were very few people who predicted it. Any sign of warmth or approval for Britain and Britain's course has to be seized upon. And, through the House Ways and Means Committee, I think there was a bill proposed just after Brexit as well from, you know, congressional Republicans. I think there is a sort of, you know, a broader fondness towards Britain and a recognition that America, even if its allies haven't done the deal, haven't been more effective recently, and America still needs allies. I mean, there's no, you know, existing alliance system may be rotting or maybe a carcass of what it previously was. But as we go forward, the United States will still need allies in different portions of the world. The question is what it asks its allies to do, or what its allies to, you know, invert a phrase much beloved of a former U.S. president. You know, the question to be asked in Britain is not what my ally can do for me, but what I can do for my ally. And so I think we're being serious about that now. I think any sign of warmth and optimism, political as it might be, in the GOP, has to be acted upon and seized upon, and you're seeing that process playing itself out.
Thanks for listening to this episode of the War on the Rocks podcast. John gave us a fascinating look into the problems of the special relationship, but more importantly, its promise. It seems likely to endure well into the future. Trump may test our alliances, but there are strong structural reasons for these alliances to endure regardless of the personalities involved. And America's special relationship with Britain is one that Trump seems actually intent on strengthening, at least for the time being. Don't forget to buy John's new book on Clement Attlee if you want more insights into modern British history. Van gave you plenty of reasons to listen to Pacific Pundit, where you could find that depth of expertise in every episode, so please do subscribe to that feed. And his book on North Korea, Rival Reputations, is very much worth your time. Don't forget to check out, of course, our written content at warontherocks.com. I'm trying to figure out a good standard sign-off for the War on the Rocks podcast. For Edward Murrow, it was good night and good luck. For Ron Burgundy, it was stay classy, San Diego. If you have an idea of what it should be, tweet it at us,